This guy hated his job, sent a letter to Clive Davis, and ended up becoming a big-time music executive. Tom Werman on the show. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming back.
Well, it worked.
Sure.
Yeah. Nice. So you went to college, and you followed, the pattern that, the path that your parents wanted you to. You hated your job.
You bet. Yeah.
And you send a letter to Clive Davis?
Yeah. It was a rather cheeky letter. It closed by saying, I'll call your office, to set up an appointment.
Nice.
And you don't tell Clive when you're going to see him.
Right.
So it's confidence.
Yes, it was. It was confidence and desperation. I really was very unhappy in my job. At that young age, you really don't always know what you're doing. I thought advertising would be cool because I thought it would be creative, and I was put in the account group, so I was responsible for creating marketing plans for Gain detergent and Jif peanut butter.
Oh boy, yeah, Snoresville.
Yeah,
yep.
Jacket and tie, windowless office. Went from a windowless office over to floor to ceiling, stereo, piano, great build, everything. I was delivered from hell to heaven.
Nice.
You think that letter, what was it in the letter that got Clive to respond to you?
Well, I told him what I was. I mean, I said, I have an MBA from Columbia. And I'm a musician. I have a good job. I don't like it. I love rock and roll music. I know you're the biggest, most sophisticated record company in the market. And I know how to play the guitar. I had a band. I think I can help you out. So he didn't just say, come on in. He handed the letter to somebody else, and somebody else started called me and said, if you're still interested, come on over. And I started to interview. So I interviewed.
How many people would have talked themselves out of sending that letter?
Yeah.
Like, he'll never respond to
me. Yeah. You won't get to him. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I got lucky. So I finally got to Clive because my interviews apparently went well. And he hired me on the spot.
And so the last time we had you on. You discovered a bunch of bands that the record label, it was at the beginning of your career, you brought a lot of bands to your record label, and they were like, nah. And it was so early in your career, you didn't have the confidence to say, no, I'm going to make a stand for this band. What were some of those bands?
That's right. That's exactly right. The first one was Kiss.
Wow, Kiss.
They made some money, then, I think, in their career.
Yeah, they were pretty successful.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and then there was Rush.
Wow.
And then Leonard Skinner. And, they were passed on by my boss, who was a smart guy, but didn't really have that much interest or knowledge about, the exploding rock and roll market. You're right. I didn't have the confidence to say you're wrong. It had been a long time. By the time I got to Skinner, it was 4 or 5 years. And, I was nervous. And because if you're an A&R man, you need to have a decent batting average. You need to sign a couple of hits now and then. So I had signed REO Speedwagon, but it had already been 4 years, since then. So, he left, fortunately.
It's almost like you
really
had a couple of seasons where you weren't batting a great average, and then you see Kiss and Rush, and you're like, okay, I'm not going to push.
Yeah.
Not only was I not batting, making a good batting average, I was on the bench,
Right.
So I finally, he left, the new boss said, what have you been doing here for 5 years? And I told him about those bands, and he said, anybody interest you right now? And it was at the time, it was Ted Nugent who had left the Amboy Dukes and was a solo act. And I wanted, again, I wanted to emphasize that I didn't talk politics with Ted.
Wow.
Yeah, no, it's sad that you can't even mention the guy's name without people like either being like really cool or like exploding into teardrops, you know?
Yeah.
It is what it is. The guy's made a lot of legendary guitar riffs and songs.
He's a great musician.
Tremendous talent.
He's a great artist.
Yeah, you shouldn't have to go around apologizing
seriously
about this.
Yeah.
You know? Really?
Well, you know, he has said some very extreme things with which I disagree. So that was the deal. But we're still in contact. He still sends me music. And, you know, he's that side of him is unfortunate to me, but he accepts the difference in our politics, and he's a really good guy. He's a trustworthy guy, and honest, and certainly outspoken.
You worked on my favorite albums of Ted Nugent. You were part of,
yeah,
Ted Nugent, Free for All, Cat Scratch Fever, Weekend Warriors.
Wow,
and Double Live Gonzo.
Big albums.
One of the greatest live albums ever recorded.
Big albums.
Yeah. We had fun.
And he wasn't someone who had a drug or alcohol issue in the studio, right?
Well, his issue was nobody was allowed to have drugs or alcohol in the studio. So, actually things went pretty quickly, and it was a very cost-effective album. The first one, and then everybody got used to it. Outside of the studio, the band, you know, did what they wanted, but certainly nothing in the studio. Ted knew basically every note that he wanted everyone to play, all the drum parts. He had it all in his head. So, you know, I became more creative with every album, but in the beginning, I was really limited to quality control. That's all I had to do. I made a lot of suggestions, but he had it together.
Was there a moment in the Cat Scratch Fever recording sessions that you had an idea for a part that we may be familiar with now?
Which part are you talking about?
I'm just wondering,
a lyric?
Yeah, lyric or a change, a bridge.
Well, I said, yeah. Yeah, no, I didn't change very much. I remember seeing him perform. The first time I ever heard Cat Scratch Fever was when he played it live. He debuted it on stage. And I called my boss after the concert and said, Ted's written a single. So that was the first hit single he had. So,
wow. As soon as you heard that, you knew. You're like, this is a single.
Yep.
Yeah, it was like there haven't been too many of those. Every Rose was one. Maybe Surrender. There were a few Flirting with Disaster, and you can tell those. But many hit singles are surprises.
Home Sweet Home. You were with Motley Crue for that recording session.
Right, and that was a surprise. Is Tommy wasn't famous for playing the piano, but he wrote the song, came up with the licks on the piano, the piano part, and I was really surprised. He just sat down in the studio one day and played it, and so I was really fond of power ballads, making power ballads, because they were one of the things that got hard rock bands onto AM radio and got them hit singles. You know, I mean, like Dream On for Aerosmith. There was Home Sweet Home. There was golly, there were so many other ones. L.A. Guns, The Ballad of Jane. I can't. There was Every Rose.
Wow.
I can't right now recall, but there were five or six.
You had a lot.
Yeah, it's a nice list.
Tom Warman is on. He's a music executive and has a book out. It's an awesome book. We're linked up on the radio station website. But you were with Motley Crue during the Theater of Pain recording sessions. That's where Home Sweet Home yeah. came from.
Right.
That was in the height of Nikki's heroin problem, right?
Yeah, pretty much. It was around there because they were pretty stressed out because they had to hurry up and follow up Shout at the Devil.
Monster so, album.
Yep, huge.
Yeah. Basically had to write 12 new songs that were really good. Thank goodness for Home Sweet Home. So, you know, the album wasn't material, and in terms of material, wasn't the best I think they had. But, you know, what happens with bands who have big hit records early in their career, they have to come back into the studio, record a follow-up, and then quickly go out on the road to support the album. They're huge. They want to make money. So there's a lot of stress, and there's some. It leads to self-medication, you know?
And Vince was also having, they were all having their issues.
Yes.
But Vince just came off of that car accident. He was arrested
yeah.
and charged with involuntary manslaughter.
Yeah.
So this is what you're dealing with in the studio. What was that like in the studio?
Well, it wasn't so bad in the studio. Their chaos was pretty much limited to their life outside the studio. They weren't the most focused band I ever produced, but they were focused enough to, you know, crank out three big hit albums. So you know, they didn't just goof off in the studio, and they weren't drugged out or lying, you know, passed out on the floor. They worked.
Did you have especially a band that is, you know, that had big hit albums that would goof off in the studio?
No. Not really, no. They were all quite serious, and you know, after I had a few hit records, they had to listen to me.
Yeah.
So, you know, a producer needs to have a measure of authority. You can hack around with your bands, you can party a little with your bands, but you need to be separate so they have a little respect and they'll listen to you when you advise them on how to make their records.
Did you have a back and forth with them with or any, on any of the Motley Crue albums where, you know, you they kind of want to have it go one way and you want to have it go another way? How would you resolve something like that?
Well, you know, a good producer is constantly trying to improve what he hears, and I would make suggestions. And this happened in rehearsal, too, in pre-production. You make a suggestion, you want to change something, you want to add something, and they try it out. They don't refuse to try it out. And if it works, you include it, you know, you incorporate it in the song, and if it doesn't work, you move on. The producer cannot dictate. A lot of bands say, oh, he wouldn't let us do this or he made us do that. That's baloney.
Yeah.
The producer is hired by the band. And so you're really working for the band. And they are supposed to feel fortunate to have you as an advisor. You know, so there were never any knockdown, drag-out fights. There were, you know, the closest I came was with Dee Snider. You know, we had some differences in material. I honestly didn't love We're Not Going to Take It in the beginning. And then, you know, I agreed to do it with them because they kind of insisted. Thank goodness.
Right.
They weren't going to take it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He wasn't thinking about it anymore.
Yeah.
Well, I, you know, it did sound a little bit like a nursery rhyme to me. And I said that, and I think it really pissed him off.
Maybe just a little bit. It's got some Bo Peep qualities to it.
Wow, it's interesting. Because it turned out to be their biggest song.
Monster right. Hit, yeah.
It's huge.
I can almost hear it now.
Yeah, it does. Mary had a little lamb, his feet white as snow.
No, but you're right. You know what's funny? A lot of songs, if you just take the words and read them, they're kind of
yeah.
dopey.
Yeah.
And it's the artists who sell it
Yeah.
Like, if you read, I know what you're saying. If you read these words on just paper, you're like, this is dumb.
Yeah, who wrote this?
This is this is something a 12-year-old would write.
Right.
But then when you hear it with the guitar, and it's an anthem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, melody, da 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 da.
Something like Tony.
Yeah, you know,
like
Yep. Steve Allen, Steve Allen, the comedian who used to have a big show, would read rock and roll lyrics on his show. He'd take a particularly dumb song lyrically. Like, I'm a girl watcher, watching girls go by, my oh my.
Great bit.
That's awesome.
You know, they were funny. It was very funny without the music. Sometimes it was funny even with the music.
You can say that, though. You can say that.
Anyway.
Yeah, you're right.
I'm a girl watcher.
Yeah.
And by the way, this guitar lead, like, not a great, in the day where Eddie Van Halen is just burning up the fretboard.
Yeah.
It's a very simple one string.
Then it goes to a guitar hard.
Very simple lead. The whole song is really kind of simple.
Yeah.
It is very simple and one of the most licensed songs in the history of rock and roll music.
Unreal.
It's amazing, isn't it? A lot of money.
Yeah. Well, look at the Beatles' early catalog. Yeah. All that stuff is very simple.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's 2.5.
Right.
It's not complicated. It's 2.5 minutes.
Yep. Make it easy.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, one of the properties of a hit song is the listener is able to sing it in the shower. So you don't want it to be too complex.
Yeah, really.
Right. Well, but then you got Rush. Right. You know, there's a band that their songs aren't
very intricate.
Those aren't singing in the shower. No. So this is smart man stuff.
It's deep,
You deep can't stuff. Tom Sawyer in the
it
shower.
Is.
Yep.
Yeah.
We'll take Tom Sawyer.
Yeah, it is smart man stuff. It was elevated, rock and roll music. That it was just. Upscale, and I that was easy. You I went to see them, and it was they made it look very easy, and they were playing some complex stuff. I was positive that they were very good. I was thrilled, and I said, boy, this is a real quality signing. And of course, the CBS turned it down. Because actually, this wasn't my boss who turned it down. It was because they wanted too much money, which in those days was $75,000 advance for two albums. And
wow,
it was too bad.
I take that now.
Wow.
Yeah, it's chump change. It's pocket change.
So they must have had other people tire kicking at that point if they're demanding more money.
Well, I can't remember his name, damn it. From Mercury Records, the guy who wound up managing my age, my memory.
Is it the age, Tom, or is it the weed and partying with Motley Crue?
After effects.
Tom Werman is on.
It's really ironic that, I'm pretty old. And in college, we used to risk 10 years in jail to get high. Now I live in Massachusetts. It's very legal. And I don't feel like getting high anymore.
Now you wouldn't go to jail for 10 years.
Damn
and
it.
Have no interest in it.
Damn
funny.
It.
Right.
Tom's got an awesome book. I hope this becomes some kind of a Netflix or movie
kind
of experience. Turn It Up, My Time Making Hit Records in the Glory Days of Rock Music. It's out now. We're linked up. I'd love to have another chance to talk with you because I could just talk with you for hours.
Seriously, man.
Great stories. Thank you, Tom. Thanks for all the memories and the music you helped create.
Thank you.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand-new luxury apartments. River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.